July 10th, 2014, in Bhaktivedanta Manor in London. And we are studying Nectar of Instruction, texts 9 through 11. So here we're talking about the goal. Oh, thank you. Here we're talking about the goal now, the end. So, first three verses was about controlling our mind, senses, anger, accepting what's favorable for bhakti, rejecting what's unfavorable. Then the next three verses were about loving exchanges and with whom to have loving exchanges, how to discern, how not to discern, with whom to have loving exchanges. And 7 and 8 were a description of the basic process. 7 for Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, 8 for Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti. And now, here at 9 to 11 is the goal. What is the best? Where are we going to? So if you can turn to text 9. Vaikuntha janito vara marupurita trapi ratsotsavad vindaranya udarapani ramanatta trapi govardana radha kundam ihapi golukapate premam ritam taplavat kuryat asya virajato giritate sevam vivekinaka. The holy place known as Mathura is spiritually superior to Vaikuntha, the transcendental world, because the Lord appeared there. Superior to Mathurapuri is the transcendental forest of Vrindavan because of Krishna's Rasalila pastimes. And superior to the forest of Vrindavan is Govardhan Hill, for it was raised by the divine hand of Sri Krishna and was the site of his various loving pastimes. And above all, the super excellent tree Radhakunda stands supreme, for it is overflooded with the ambrosial nectarian prema of the Lord of Gokula, Sri Krishna. Where then is that intelligent person who is unwilling to serve this divine Radhakunda, which is situated at the foot of Govardhan Hill? Text 10. Karmi bhya parito harer priyataya vyaktim yayur gyaninas tebyo gyana vimukta bhakti parama premai kanistastata tebyasta pasupala pankajab distastabhyo pisaradika presta tadvadiyam tadya sarasati tamna shrayat kakriti. In the Shastra, it is said that of all kinds of fruitive workers, he who is advanced in knowledge of the higher values of life is favored by the Supreme Lord Hari. Out of many such people who are advanced in knowledge, jnanis, one who is practically liberated by virtue of his knowledge may take to devotional service. He is superior to the others. However, one who has actually attained prema, pure love of Krishna, is superior to him. The gopis are exalted above all the advanced devotees because they are always totally dependent upon Sri Krishna, the transcendental cowherd boy. Among the gopis, Srimati Radharani is the most dear to Krishna. Her kundalik is as profoundly dear to Lord Krishna as this most beloved of the gopis. Who then will not reside at Radhakund and in a spiritual body surcharge with ecstatic devotional feelings of Prakriti Bhava, render loving service to the divine couple Sri Sri Radha Govinda, who perform their Asta Kaliya Lila, their eternal eightfold daily pastimes? Indeed, those who execute devotional service on the banks of Radhakund are the most fortunate people in the universe. Krishna sochai pranaya vasati prayasibhyo pirata kundam chasya munibir abhitasta drigeva vyadayi yat pristar api alam masulabam kim punar bhakti bhajam tat premidam sakrit api saras natur aviskaroti. Of the many objects of favored delight and of all the lovable damsels of Rajabhumi, Srimati Radharani is certainly the most treasured object of Krishna's love. And in every respect, her divine kunda is described by great sages as similarly dear to him. Undoubtedly, Radhakunda is very rarely attained, even by the great devotees. Therefore, it is even more difficult for ordinary devotees to attain. If one simply bathes once within those holy waters, one's pure love of Krishna is fully aroused. Quite a benediction, huh? So everybody wants to live in the best place. Everybody's looking, you know, where's the best place to live? Where's the best place to go? What's the best destination to have? And people look for things like, where's there good schools and low crime rates and things like that. So here, Rupa Goswami is giving us
what's the better and best places in text 9, and then what's the better and best people in text 10, and then in 11 he's focusing on Srimati Radharani and Radhakund. And it's interesting, of course, that the places and the people have a correspondence. Places and the people have a correspondence. Now, Krishna is the engineer and the designer, and he's engineered certain bodies, certain types of people, certain mentalities to live in certain places. I remember seeing a nature film about these walruses or seals that live in the Antarctic Ocean and how they have special apparatus to keep the cold water, the ice cold water that's just probably, 0.5 degrees from freezing their organs. And in this nature show we were showing at the Gurukula, the scientist was saying, "Well, just see how they've evolved." And I thought, no, as a designer, the designer has designed a particular body to match a particular environment. So the bodies and the environments are according to consciousness. They're according to consciousness. So we have the description of the better and best places. So the best place, you could say, is Vaikuntha, the spiritual world. Right. And there everything is above anxiety. There's no anxiety. Now what rasas? Do you know what rasas are in Vaikuntha? Everybody knows what rasas are in Vaikuntha? Neutral and servitorship. Shanta and Dasya. Shanta means the peaceful ras. Shanta is peaceful. So there are many residents of Vaikuntha that aren't really even actively serving Lord Narayan and Lakshmi. Well, they're in Shanta ras. If you're in Shanta ras, you're not doing active service. Dasya ras means you're doing active service. So they're there. They're there in Vaikuntha, and they're a peaceful being with the Lord. There's also different kinds of liberation. You can have a body like the Lord or like Lakshmi. You can live on the same planet as the Lord. You can be a close associate of the Lord. You can have the same opulences of the Lord. But not every resident of Vaikuntha has all of those opulences. So some of the residents of Vaikuntha look just like Narayan and just like Lakshmi, and some don't. There's a nice explanation in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, if you really want to read about Vaikuntha. That's a very wonderful, where Gopakumar is seeing all these different residents of Vaikuntha entering into the gates. And they have all varieties of forms and all varieties of opulences. And some are very close associates of the Lord and some are not. It's kind of like the absolute perfect heaven, where there's only goodness, there's no passion, there's no ignorance, there's no envy, there's no malice, there's no police force needed, there's no jails, there's no sannyas, there's nothing to renounce. And everybody is full of transcendental bliss. So that's Vaikuntha. And whatever activities we have here, they have there, but just for enjoyment. And many, many thousands and millions of times more activities. It's described, every day is a festival. So they're constantly celebrating something. And it's just always having a party in Vaikuntha. And there's Lord Narayan and Lakshmi. There's no anxiety, there's no grief, there's no birth, death, old age, and disease, and so forth. So you could say, well, what's higher than that? So Rupa Goswami says, higher than that is Mathura in the material world. Because in Mathura, in the material world, the Lord appears. And he demonstrates his appearance, his baby pastimes, and so forth. So by Mathura, he means the whole Mathura Mandala. Now, this can also be understood to mean Goloka Vrindavan in the spiritual world, which is made up of Vrindavan forest, Vraja village, and Mathura city and Dwarka city. So it can be understood when we say it's higher. And again, if you really want to get a sense of the different realms, then Brihad Bhagavatamrita is the book to read. So the BBT have an edition now in three huge volumes. And the first book is What's the Better and Best Devotee? And the second and third book, which is part two, is What's the Better and Best Place? And the protagonist, Gopakumar, is going in this planet, and then he goes to Indra's planet, and he goes to the Prajapatis, and he goes to the sages, and he goes to Brahma's planet, and he goes to the coverings of the universe, and he goes to the Brahmajyoti, and he sees Lord Shiva, and he goes to Vaikuntha, and he goes to Ayodhya, and he goes to Dwarka, and he goes to Vrindavan. So higher even than Vaikuntha is Goloka Vrindavan, or even, you could say, in the material world, Mathura, because there Krishna has a variety of activities, of intimate activities. So, of course, we as Gaudiyas we explain that Krishna is higher, first of all, because he says he is. He says, Matta Parjaram Nanyat, there's nothing superior to me, Ishwaraha Paramaha Krishna. But logically, Krishna is higher because he's Akila Rasamrita Murti. All the various rasas are in Krishna, are exhibited in relationship with Krishna, whereas with Narayana, that's not the fact. Narayana doesn't have a mother and father. Narayana has his consort Lakshmi, but he's not engaged in general conjugal relationships or even in friendly relationships. Everybody's very reverential in Vaikuntha. So therefore we say that Krishna is the more original form. But it's interesting because there are people who worship Lord Narayana who feel that Narayana is the original. There are Vaishnavas who consider Narayana to be supreme and Krishna to be a manifestation of Narayana. And what's even more interesting is, according to Brihad Bhagavatamrita, the residents of Vaikuntha think that way. The residents of Vaikuntha don't think Krishna is the original and Narayana is an incarnation. They think that Narayana is the original and Krishna is an incarnation. Because their supreme lord is Narayana. And it's quite interesting, even in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, those who are worshipping Lord Shiva, when residents of Vaikuntha come and Gopakumar says, who are they? So Ganesh speaks to Gopakumar a little bit on the side. He says, the associates of Lord Shiva, they don't want to know about these people who are on a higher platform. They're satisfied with their position. Now, why would the worshippers of Narayana feel that Narayana is superior to Krishna? Why do they feel that Narayana is a higher form of God or more complete form of God? Any idea?
Because this is their rasa and they want to...
Ultimately, yes. But how do you think they explain it? What kind of logic do they use?
Attracted to his opulence.
Yes.
They don't see the sinfulness...
As being attractive, which is very much like what you said, but a little bit more specific. Yeah, and see, it's almost circular reasoning. They're saying God is the King of Kings. That's how they're defining God. You know what circular reasoning is, right? Why? Because. Or a woman is a female and a female is a woman. You just, it's circular, it's victory by definition. You're just going in a circle. So if you say that the definition of God is the King of Kings, if that's how you define... Whoa! In my last few hours in London, I get to see you. So if you define God as the King of Kings, then wherever he's the most kingly must be the supreme form. If that's how you understand God. And then you'll think that a more intimate form must be some incomplete form because he's not very kingly. You know, in Vrindavan and in Mathura and in Dwarka, Krishna is not the king. Who's the king in Vrindavan? Radharani. Radharani. We love you, Radharani. Who's the king in Vrindavan? No, he's not. Certainly is not.
Nanda Maharaj.
Yes, Radharani. Aww. We call Radharani the queen of Vrindavan, but really Radharani is not there as the queen. She's there as a princess. Mm-hmm. Who's the queen?
Mother
Yasoda. And then there's Visravanu and his wife are also kings and queens of their realm. And Radharani's a princess. Now, she's the queen of Vrindavan in that they had a ceremony to crown her queen of Vrindavan. And she's queen of Vrindavan in the sense that she's the most beloved, as it's saying in the last verse. So it's like that. But Radharani is not the queen of Vrindavan in terms of running the place. Mm-hmm. She's not that kind of queen. Mm-hmm. She's not an administrative queen. Yeah. Whereas Mother Yasoda is an administrative queen. Mm-hmm. And Nanda Maharaj is an administrative king. They are running Vrindavan. They're managing things. I mean, Vrinda Devi is another administrative type person. She's the administrator in the forest. You know, Nanda Maharaj and Yasoda aren't really in charge of the forest. I mean, that's their domain, but Vrinda Devi's running the forest. So Krishna and Radharani are not the administrators in Vrindavan. They're not. Krishna is not having that role. Who is Krishna in Vrindavan? He's the? He's a cowherd boy. But he's Nanda Maharaj's son, so he's kind of like the prince. Mm. He's kind of like a princely cowherd boy. And he's not even the older one. Yeah. So what does the younger prince do? Right? And he can just be an enjoyer. You follow? In Vaikuntha, Narayana is the king. There's not another king. Narayana is the king. In Vrindavan, Krishna is the younger prince. He has an older brother who is a kshatriya, who's known as Vasudeva's son, who's a kshatriya. And his father is the king. He's not the king. What about in Mathura and Dwarka? Who's the king? Ugrasena. Again, Krishna's not the king. He's not the king. And so to people who think of God as the king of kings, to them Krishna is more like a minor incarnation. Mm-hmm. They don't really see him as very important, nor do they see him as being the topmost form of the Lord. So if you think in terms of, if you define God in terms of majesty, then Narayan is superior. But if you define God in terms of completeness, then Krishna is superior. Because Krishna has relationships that Narayan just doesn't have. Of course, they're really the same person. They're not two different persons. It's not that there's a Krishna and there's a Narayan as two different people. It's really kind of Krishna at work and Krishna at home. And just like when you go to work, you wear different clothes. And not only do you wear different clothes, you act a little differently at work. Yes? I hope. People don't act at work the same way that they act at home. Generally.
They can't,
generally, unless they have a very unusual kind of job. But generally. So when Krishna is at work, you know, he's in a more formal atmosphere. Or you can think of it like, you know, the Queen of England, that when she's at a state dinner and when she's with her family. I'm sure she doesn't dress up all in hat and gloves when she's just hanging around her husband and her kids. You are? I can't imagine she wears. I can't imagine she wears her hat and gloves. You know, every waking. Not at home. No, not every waking minute. It's not that. It's not that when she's hanging out with her children and grandchild that she has to have her white gloves on. So, and they're calling. You know, her grandchildren are going to call her grandma. They're not going to call her Your Majesty. Or, you know, in our America, we have President Obama right now, so his wife's going to call him, you know, hubby or Barack. She's not going to say, oh, excuse me, Mr. President, you know, I've done your laundry today. So he's the same person, but when he's at a state dinner, even his wife has to be very formal. And when they're in their own home, his wife is very informal. So Narayan and Krishna are exactly the same person. But Narayan is like at a state dinner all the time. And Krishna is at home. So in that way we say, our Gaudiya Vaishnava view is, first of all, we have a lot of Shastric statements that Krishna is supreme, so based on the Shastra, but also based on our logic that the form of the Lord that has the most variety of rasas is the most complete form. Whereas Narayana, it simply doesn't exhibit more than two rasas with the devotees. All right, so we have, in Vaikuntha, we just have two rasas with on reverence. Then we have the whole Mathura Mandala, the whole area of Mathura, that's Mathura, Dwarka, and Vrindavan. And there we have all of the rasas, right? And all varieties of devotees, and all the rasas in many different varieties of rasa also. So there's Vatsalya Ras, but not all the Vatsalya Ras are literally like Nandini Yasoda. Krishna has nurses, right? And he has, just like Balaram is described as being Sakya with some Vatsalya. Balaram is Krishna's brother, but he feels somewhat parental. So Balaram's gopis feel like that too. You know, if Balaram has his own gopis. You all know Balaram has his own gopis. So they're going to feel somewhat parental towards Krishna. He's kind of like their boyfriend's little brother. You know? So they're going to have a parental, although they're gopis with Balaram, their mood towards Krishna is more parental, is more. So you see all the different varieties that there's going to be, and then there's teachers where they're going to have their kind of parental, and then we might have talked about the other day how there's among the cowherd boys, we said there's some who are older who are mixed with parental, some younger mixed. We talked about this, right? Mixed with service, and then there's so many different varieties. So ultimately, each jiva is their own category. So, you know, you can talk about, okay, there's three kinds of cowherd boys. Then in those three kinds, there's sub-kinds, and then there's sub-sub, and then there's sub-sub-sub-sub-kinds. And eventually you get to each particular cowherd boy who has his own personal, individual relationship with Krishna. Okay, then Rupa Goswami is saying, all right, of all of this area of Vrindavan, which is superior, then the forests of Vrindavan, he's saying, are superior to Mathura in general. Now, although he's talking about superior, they're within. Although it's very hard to talk about space, because space is one of the gross material elements. Time is the beginning of illusion. The first thing that happens to create the material illusion is time. Who's Lord Shiva? Who's the personification of ahankara? There's a direct relationship between time and ahankara. We're not going to talk about that now. And then among the gross elements, the first gross element to be created is space. Therefore, there isn't space as we know it, or time as we know it, in this material world. Even in this universe, space and time exist quite differently on Lord Brahma's planet than they do on this Earth planet. Quite differently. They're not experiencing, Lord Brahma is not experiencing time the way we experience time, for sure. So what to speak of in the spiritual world, where there isn't a creation of material time or material space. Therefore, when we're talking about space, you have to keep in mind we're using a word that's not fully applicable. That doesn't really, it's not really the right word. But we just don't have any other way to explain it. You all get that? We're doing the best we can. But we should keep in mind that we're not literally talking about material space. So you have Vaikuntha, right? You've seen the painting. So you have Vaikuntha, and within Vaikuntha is Goloka Vrindavan, is the planet of Goloka. So when we say Goloka is higher to Vaikuntha, Mathura is higher to Vaikuntha, it's in Vaikuntha. It's part of Vaikuntha. And then in the Mathura Mandala, the forests of Vrindavan are the highest. So, you know, there's even the village of Raj, like Nandigram is described in Ananda Vrindavan Champu, is very opulent. Nandamarja's home in the streets, it's a town, it's a small town, it's a village. But then there's the forest where there's the deer and the river and the et cetera, even tigers and the peacocks. So that's considered higher. But what rasa is not so much manifested in the forest? Well, awe and reverence is not there altogether. But of the different rasas, which rasas are not so much prevalent in the forest?
Vatsalya.
So we don't see, generally, Nandini, Yasoda, Rohini, they don't go into the forest. I mean, they go to Kali's lake when Krishna's in trouble. But, you know, they go to Govardhan when Krishna lifts Govardhan Hill. But generally, we're seeing Sakya and Madhurya and some Dasya. There are some servants who accompany Krishna into the forest, like Raktak and Patrak. They come, Prabhupada mentions another one here, I think, Chitrak and Patrak and Raktak. they come with Krishna. They may come with Krishna into the forest. But most of the servants are going to be in the town, and the parents are going to be in the town. So the primary rasas we're going to find in the forest are going to be Sakya and Madhurya. There's also, Vrinda Devi has her servants. So she has her assistants who are also in Dasya Ras. Okay, so then, of all the forests of Vrindavan, so within the forest of Vrindavan, the highest is Govardhan Hill. And at Govardhan Hill, we really find, again, mostly Sakya and Madhurya. We don't so much find the other rasas. And here it's even more intimate, and of course, Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill. So here, of all the forests, Krishna is having more intimate pastimes at Govardhan. Then, at Govardhan, at the foot of Govardhan Hill, the most intimate place is Radhakund. Now, at Radhakund, you have pretty much just Madhurya, although sometimes some of the cowherd boys also go there. Some of Krishna's intimate cowherd boys, Subal, Sridhama, Ujwala, they go to Radhakund because they're also engaged in messages between Krishna and the gopis and so forth. Madhu Mangal, who's not exactly a cowherd boy, but he's in Sakya Ras. So he's also going to Radhakund. But primarily, it's Madhurya Ras that's there. And of course, at Radhakund, it's only Madhurya Ras with Radharani and her group. So at other places in Govardhan and even at Shamakund, there's going to be other groups of gopis there besides Radharani's groups. So, you know, Srila Prabhupada talks about how there's, out of many, many millions of gopis, there's 16,000 main gopis. Of the 16,000, there's 108 that are most prominent. Of the 108, there's 8 that are the most prominent. Does anyone know who those 8 are? These are not Radharani's 8. These are the 8 principal gopis. These are not Radharani's 8 friends. Anyone know who the principal 8 gopis are? Okay, well, you know one of them is Radharani. And who's the second one? Lalita's there.
Vishakha.
So Radharani, Lalita, and Vishakha. Those are the 3 of the 8 that are Radharani's group. And who else is there? Who's the second?
Chandravali
is there. And then 2 gopis from her group, Padma and Saibhya, are there. And then Padma and Saibhya. Those are Chandravali's chief friends, just like Radharani has Lalita and Vishakha. And then there's Shamala, who's a different group of gopis, but she's friendly to Radharani. She's not in Radharani's group, but she's friendly to Radharani. And then there's Bhadra, who's again her own group, and she's friendly to Chandravali. So those are the 8 chief gopis. There are some other lists sometimes of the 10 chief gopis, which then include gopis like Gopali Tarika or Pali. And so there's other lists of 10 and 12 chief gopis, but those are the 8 chief gopis. Prabhupada mentions them in a few places. When Krishna returns to Ras Lila, there's the description in Bhagavatam of the gopis who greet him are the first 7. So there's first Chandravali is mentioned, then Padma, then Saibhya, then Radharani, then Lalita. No, first Chandravali, then Shamala. Chandravali, Shamala, then Padma, then Saibhya, then Radharani, then Lalita, then Vishakha, and Bhadra is not mentioned in that list. Although they're not mentioned by name, the Acharyas tell us that these descriptions are of these 7, and then there's a similar description in Ras Lila, which is also these. But at Radhakund, there's just Radharani's group. So Bhadra doesn't go there, and Shamala doesn't go there, and Chandravali doesn't go there. That's just Radharani's place. Although at Shamakund, the other gopis are there, and at Govardhan, the other gopis are there. So we start narrowing. It's interesting that we sort of first expand the number of rasas and the number of people, and then again we narrow them. Mm-hmm. Are you all following what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So we start with Vaikuntha, that's just Shantaras and Dasyaras. Then we go to, we're going to Mathura, but with this more of the rasas and all varieties, and everybody's in Mathura Mandal, everybody's there. And then you go to the forest of Vrindavan, and it's more intimate, but there's fewer rasas. And Govardhan also, and then you go to Radhakund, and it's only really one with a little bit of Sakya, and only Radharani. So you go to the highest place, and it's become narrow again. Okay, so that's text 9. And then in text 10, Rupa Goswami is giving us people. Because again, when you're talking about gradations of places, you're talking about places like we were talking about the Antarctic walruses. So there's a match between consciousness, form, and place. These things go together. I mean, even on this planet, it's like that. There tend to be neighborhoods of criminals and neighborhoods of intellectuals. I mean, we tend to have places like that, right? Where like-minded people tend to live together. Mm-hmm. Even in a city where there's a gazillion different kinds of people, a city like London or New York, there's so many different kinds of people, different nationalities, different. But you tend to have neighborhoods. Certain people live in this neighborhood. Oh, that's a dangerous neighborhood. Don't go there. Right? And you go to some neighborhoods and there's rubbish all over the street and broken windows and graffiti, and you go to another neighborhood and everything's posh and there's doormen standing there with white gloves. Yes? So we tend to group together by consciousness. And of course, consciousness is also reflected in form. Our material form is some reflection of our consciousness, and certainly the spiritual form is a manifestation of our particular way of loving Krishna. So in talking about you, because you might ask, well, why are there better and best places? What determines it? It's a consciousness of the people. So Rupa Goswami is explaining if we look again at text 10. So we have all kinds of fruit of workers. So fruit of workers is basically somebody who's working for themselves. They're working because they want fruit. And fruit of workers are in ignorance, passion, and goodness. So of all kinds of fruit of workers, someone who has higher values of life. So that would be your people in upper Rajagun and in Sattvagun. So the Vijnanis, Vikarmis, they're in Tamagun. They want fruit. People in ignorance, they want fruit, but they want fruit right now with as little worker sacrifice as possible. That's what it means in ignorance. I want my enjoyment right now. If you think about a fast food restaurant, you know, I want to eat something that tastes good to me. I want it right now. I don't care about who has suffered to give me this food. I don't care what animals have suffered. I don't care what workers in the restaurant have suffered. I don't care how I'm going to suffer for eating this food. I just want my pleasure right now. I want it as fast as possible. And whatever health or karmic reactions there are, I'll worry about them later. So that's very much the vikarma. So they're fruit of workers. They're fruit of workers. But they don't want to plant a seed and water a tree and take care of the tree. And you know, they'll just steal your fruit. That's kind of the mood of the vikarmis. You know, they'll just pour chemical fertilizers on the land and pour antibiotics into the animals and inflate the economic system and whatever they can do to get their fruit very quickly and very easily, and you know, to hell with whatever reactions, to hell with the fact that they're going to have to go to hell later on for doing this. So that's the vikarmis. And then among all the vikarmis, Krishna is very pleased with those, as it says here. Those who are advanced in knowledge of the higher values of life is favored by the Supreme Lord. So Krishna gives favor to those in Rajagun and Sattvagun. So in Rajagun, you want a fruit, but you want to get your fruit ethically and honestly, and you're willing to work for it, and you're willing to wait for it, and you're willing to go through some trouble for it. So that's Rajagun. You still want a fruit, but if you have to sacrifice for 10 years or 20 years to get your fruit, you will do that. And you'll sacrifice according to the rules of the scriptures. In Vikarma, you just make up and do whatever you want. In Rajagun, in Karma, you follow the scriptural rules to get what you want. So Krishna is very, 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 very pleased with those who give up Tamagun and come to Rajagun. You know, the epitome of Rajagun is the Raja, is the king, the pious king who protects the citizens and engages in yajnas and, you know, and so Krishna is very pleased with that. And of course, even higher than that are those who are in Sattvagun. And in Sattvagun, you tend to start moving away from fruit of workers, and you tend to start moving towards Gyan. You tend to start moving towards purification. So then among all of those people, even higher than those, are those who are Gyanis. So these are, again, people who are in Sattvagun. They're interested in Brahman. They're interested in purification. At least they're interested in the higher planets, where there's not so much lust and envy and anger and greed. So they're even better. And then, among those people, some are actually liberated. So most people, even in Sattvagun, they're not really liberated. They're interested in peace and balance and love and compassion and harmony, and, you know, or Brahman. But most of them are not really liberated. Some of them are just poets and philosophers on this planet. Some of them are demigods on higher planets. Some of them are great sages on higher planets. But among all those, some are really liberated. Some have realized that they're in Brahman, that they're spirit. So they're even higher. And then of those, there are those who are higher, those who are in bhakti, those who are trying to love God. And then all of those who are loving God, the highest is those who have achieved love of God. So those who are trying to get love of God, those who have actually attained prema. And then Rupa Goswami just jumps of all the devotees who have attained prema, and the highest of them are the gopis. So this is quite a jump compared to, say, Brihad Bhagavatamrita, where you have all these different levels of devotees in prema. You know, there's Prahlad Maharaj, there's the Hanuman, there's the Yadus, there's the residents of Vrindavan, and so forth, until you finally get to the gopis. And the same with part two, with the places like that. So here Rupa Goswami's not giving all the gradations. And why are the gopis the highest? Because they're totally dependent upon Sri Krishna. They don't have any other dependents. They don't have any other shelter. So the gopis don't take shelter of their husbands and their families, and they only are taking shelter of Krishna. Whereas everyone else has other shelters. You know, those who are in Vatsalya Ras, which is considered, you know, the second highest rasa. So they have their spouses, they have their own children, often, you know, the other elderly members of Vrindavan who are think like Krishna or Balaram as their children. And the cowherd boys also, they have their family, they're into their... So it's a little different. The gopis have this complete dependence on Krishna, not on anything else. And of course, their relationship with Krishna is very secret, although it's not very, very secret. I mean, we have Radhakrishna deities all over the planet, which is a little outrageous if you think about it. You know, the Radharani is supposed to be married to Abhimanyu. So here's God, and here's his girlfriend who happens to be somebody else's wife. You know, it's a. Of course, we don't say that to people, but you know, if they read the books a little bit, they'll sort of figure it out. So that's their only dependent on Sri Krishna. They have no dependence even on ordinary dharma. They don't have anything else. Whereas you find that in the other rasas, they do. There's some sense of ordinary dharma. There's some sense of, you know, even worshipping Narayana. Right, Nandamarja and Mother Yasoda, they're worshipping Narayana. Oh, please protect Krishna. But they're worshipping Narayana. Well, the gopis don't really do that. I mean, they worship Katyayani. But that's, it's mostly just play. You know, they worship the sun god. That's entirely play. It's entirely playful. So they're only dependent upon Sri Krishna. And then of all of the gopis, there's Srimati Radharani. So she's the chief of all the billions and billions and billions of gopis. And then here he's saying, so once you understand this, then why wouldn't you go to Radharani's place, Radhakund? Once you understand that this is the highest personality, then why wouldn't you go to her place? So who then will not reside at Radhakund? And in a spiritual body, so charged with ecstatic devotional feelings of Prakriti Bhava, render loving service to the divine couple, Sri Sri Radha Govinda, who perform their Astakaliya Lila, their eternal eightfold daily pastimes. So, of course, as you remember, when we were in text 8, we were talking about Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti. So here, Rupa Goswami is assuming, because this book is a progression, that you already performed Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti and you're now absorbed in the eightfold pastimes of Radha and Krishna. Now, I find it completely, totally, absolutely fascinating that Srila Prabhupada translated the Nectar of Instruction and translated this verse saying that one should meditate on the eightfold pastimes of Radha and Krishna. But there's nowhere in Srila Prabhupada's books where he clearly and explicitly explains the eightfold daily pastimes of Radha and Krishna. Indirectly, but not directly. Now, there are books that describe the eightfold daily pastimes of Radha and Krishna, particularly Govinda Lilamrita by Krishna Das Kaviraj, and also Krishna Kanaika Kamudi of Kavi Kanapur. Those are the two main ones, and then there are a few others. But Srila Prabhupada did not translate those books. And it's just kind of interesting that, and nor did Srila Prabhupada really encourage us to read those books. So it's sort of interesting that Prabhupada is translating this instruction of Rupa Goswami to meditate on these pastimes, but he doesn't explicitly give them. So that's just, I'm just simply making an observation in that regard. Now, does this mean that everybody should go run to Radhakund? So my daughter and her family lived at Govardhan for 6 years. And for, I guess, about 4 years, they had a place that was about a 40-45 minute walk from their place to Radhakund. Then later they moved closer to Aniyur, which was more like a 2 hour walk. But when they were living 40-45 minutes away, I stayed with them for 3 months, and Kartik in 2 more months. And so I was regularly walking up to Radhakund. 45 minutes wasn't that long. You know, you walk up to Radhakund and stay there and chant for a while, and then you take a rickshaw back or you walk back. And I had a little booklet with me, and I found out all the places at Radhakund. And we took pictures, and I've made a, I don't know if I've ever showed it here. I don't think so, but I have a multimedia virtual tour of Radha Kund and Shama Kund. I have shown it here? Okay. Where have I, where did I show it? In the temple?
Yeah, the temple.
I did?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I have this virtual tour. So I was in one country a year or so ago where people asked me to show it. And I found out later that one of the devotees who saw the show immediately packed her bags and went to Radha Kund. Although it was May. Upon which she got extremely sick. To go from May in Europe to May in Vrindavan is not a very good idea as far as how the human body functions. She said, well, I'm really glad I went, but I was really sick the whole time. So I told her later, I said, I think you're a little nuts. So it's not that just because we read that who then would not reside at Radha Kund, okay, all right, finished. Sell everything, pack everything, close the temple here. Everybody get on the plane. And let's go to Radha Kund. So we should understand that although Radha Kund's the best place, it may not be the best place for me. Even if we're pure devotees, it may not be the best place for me. If when you wake up to your eternal rasa, you find out that you're in Vatsalya rasa, then it's not your place at all. You know, if you find out you're one of Krishna's nursemaids, then what in the world are you going to do at Radha Kund? Such people don't even go there. If you're one of Krishna's cowherd boys or one of Balaram's cowherd boys, you know, what are you going to do there? You're not even going to go there. So even if you're a pure devotee, that may not be your place. What to speak of if we're not a pure devotee? Srila Prabhupada would not be happy with us living at Radha Kund. No way. There is no way that that would please Srila Prabhupada if we closed all the temples and packed all of our bags and we all moved to Radha Kund. Also, there's enough space at Radha Kund on the material level for all of us to live there. We would also find it quite austere to live at Radha Kund. We probably wouldn't make it. We'd probably live there for a while and be like, get me back to London. It wouldn't be very real. We have to remember that the way that we attain Krishna consciousness is by pleasing Krishna, and we please Krishna by following his instructions and the instructions that's right for us, not just by saying, oh, Radha Kund is the best place. Well, I deserve the best place, so I'm going to go to the best place. And even if Radha Kund is a good place for you, it might not be the place for you now. I have a very good friend who's lived in Mayapur for many, many years and then moved to Vrindavan when she got very sick. She's lived in Vrindavan for many years, and for a while she was staying at Radha Kund every year for several months. And eventually she gave up her place there. She said, I don't belong there. It's not the place for me. She said, I really need to be in Vrindavan, you know, with the ISKCON devotees, with Prabhupada's devotees, and not just off by myself at Radha Kund. She said, if I really want to be connected to Prabhupada, I need to be here. That was very interesting. She said that we really enter into Radha Kund more by hearing and by meditation rather than by staying at the physical place. She also had a very interesting realization. She realized that a lot of the people who live at Radha Kund are not entering into the spiritual Radha Kund at all. I mean, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati said that a lot of those people are not living in Radha Kund. He said they're living in Naraka Kund, which means hell. But her realization is that a lot of those people had a false ego conception that I live at Radha Kund, which really was a sort of material designation. I'm a very spiritual person and I live at Radha Kund. And her realization was that a lot of these people are just going to take birth on the material manifestation, on what we call the film, the material film, over and over and over and over and over again. Then it might be a very long time before they would, because that's what they want. It's not that Krishna is punishing them or something. That's what they want. They want to live there as in austerity and have this kind of pride that I'm an austere person living at Radha Kund. And so we should be very, very careful that just the fact that you're physically living at Radha Kund doesn't mean that you're living at Radha Kund. And the fact that you're living in London, you know, you may be living at Radha Kund. In your mind, in your mentality, in your heart. And we should remember also that this book is written by Rupa Goswami. Rupa Goswami is also Rupa Manjari. And so, of course, Rupa Manjari has a place at Radhakund. And so Rupa Goswami is also speaking from his own personal ecstasy. Who then would not reside at Radhakund? Well, Nanda Maharaj doesn't reside at Radhakund. You follow? Who then would not reside at Radhakund and in a spiritual body surcharged with devotional feelings? Well, lots of people wouldn't live at Radhakund, even in the spiritual world. So he's also speaking out of his own ecstasy, out of his own particular rasa, out of his own particular relationship. And then we go on to the last verse, where, although in text 10, Rupa Goswami was glorifying Radhakund and living there in relation to all these other places, in text 11, he's just talking about Radharani and Radhakund. He's not talking about Radharani and Radhakund in comparison to anything else. So in 9, he was talking about all the places, comparing one place to another. In text 10, he's comparing all the people to one another. And in text 11, he's just talking about Radharani and Radhakund. And he tells us that it's very rarely attained. And Prabhupada talks about in the purport how if you engage in Vaidhi Bhakti, there's no question, if that's all you do, if you never advance to Raghunuga Bhakti, there's no question of going to Radhakund. Those who engage in Vaidhi Bhakti can go to Vaikuntha or to Dwaraka. Again, this is not a punishment. That means that's what they want. We're all getting what we want. It's not like, oh, you lowly people who are only engaging in Vaidhi Bhakti. No, it's not. That's a very material way of looking at things. Krishna also likes Dwarka. He also likes his family at Dwarka, and he also likes Vaikuntha. And devotees who want to be there, and that's, they, you know, it's like, Hare Krishna. Yes. But he's saying that Radhakund is not very easy to obtain, and that one should at least try to take a bath there once. He said, and if one takes a bath there, that one can attain a pure love of Krishna. And Prabhupada talks about, if you can't live there, you should at least take bath as many times as possible. And this is a very important item in devotional service. And then he says, Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes that Radhakund is the most select place for those interested in advancing their devotional service in the wake of the lady friend Sakis and confidential serving maids, Manjaris, of Srimati Radharani. Some people say that the conditioned souls can only become Manjaris, but it's quite clear here from Bhaktivinoda and Srila Prabhupada that some persons who are gopis are sakis, and some persons who are gopis are manjaris. Again, there's unlimited variety. And thinking that everybody has to be one thing is a very peculiar and materialistic way of looking at things. And I would venture to say even a little impersonal way of looking at things, that we're all eternal persons and we all have our own place. So here Prabhupada is saying if one can bathe even once, one can develop transcendental love for Krishna exactly as the gopis did. One should bathe there regularly and give up all material conceptions. Then he says, if one is thus constantly engaged during his lifetime after giving up the body, he will return back to Godhead to serve Radha in the same way as he contemplated during his life on the banks of Radhakund. So now this does not mean, my dear friends, that you can say, okay, I'm going to go to Radhakund and I'm going to just pretend that I'm a gopi and I'm just going to sit there. And there are people who do this. I've met them. I've met some of them face to face. So they just go there and they make a little map of all the holy places and they meditate on the Eightfold Pastimes and they imagine that they're gopis at Radhakund. But unless they've actually awakened to Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti, it's meaningless. It just doesn't mean anything. And in fact, if someone's rasa hasn't awakened and they do this kind of thing, they're going to hinder their actual awakening. Because maybe they're not a gopi, maybe they're a cowherd boy, maybe they're a cow. And because they're there concentrating on this gopi lila, but they're not a gopi, it's very hard, like Prabhupada says, it's hard to wake up someone who's pretending to be asleep. So in a very similar way, if you're trying to be something that you're not, it's very hard for Krishna to reveal to you what you are. Does that make sense to everybody? So therefore, Bhaktivinoda warns that to imitate these things on the basis of the mind will impede one's spiritual progress. Now, if you've actually woken up to who you are and you've woken up to the fact that you are one of Radharani's gopis and you do live at Radhakund, then it's exactly what you should do, is meditate on these things. But if that hasn't awakened in you, then when Prabhupada's saying you'll get whatever you meditate on, that's with the understanding that your internal rasa has awakened. So this is sometimes a point, is do we have an inherent rasa? Or is our rasa simply a result of what we choose to meditate on in this life? So, unfortunately, the rye that was supposed to bring me back here was very late, and therefore I did not have the time to write down everything that I wanted to do for this class. But there's a very nice purport in the third canto of the Bhagavatam, and so I'm very sorry, I don't have the verse. I had planned to be back at 4 and gather all these together, and instead I got back at 4:55 by the arrangement of the Lord, not my arrangement. So there's a verse in the third canto where Lord Kapiladeva says that the Lord takes whatever form the devotees worship in them. And Srila Prabhupada in his purport and Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur in his purport make it very clear that our rasa is inherent. It must be. It must be. Otherwise, how are we individual persons eternally? What does it mean to be a person? What does that mean? That you're a person. That you have a personality. So our eternal personality is in relationship to Krishna. We do not have an eternal personality not in relationship to Krishna. That's what it means. That's what spiritual means. The whole definition of Maya is that which is not in relationship to Krishna. That's the definition of Maya. Spiritual is in relation to Krishna. When we say that we have an eternal, that we have eternal individuality, it doesn't simply mean that we're all exactly the same, but we're just geographically separated, like we're just a bunch of little lights in the sky, separated from each other like Christmas lights on a Christmas tree. Remember that our concept of space in this world is a material concept. So it isn't like that in the ultimate reality. So when we talk about that we're eternal individuals, when Krishna said to Arjuna, you and I and all these kings, we've always existed, we exist now, we will always exist in the future, which Prabhupada gives us strong evidence of eternal individuality going backwards and forwards in time, that means we have a personality. And if we had a personality that was not in relationship with Krishna, then it would be an illusory personality. We must have a personality in relationship with Krishna. That doesn't mean it's not our choice. We eternally choose, which is a little hard for us to understand when we're caught in space-time. What does it mean that one eternally is choosing to be something? We think of choosing as, well, this at this point I haven't chosen, at this point I've chosen. You know, at 9 o'clock I hadn't yet made a choice, and at 9:05 I made a choice. But the soul is choosing their relationship with Krishna. It's a manifestation of their internal desire, and yet that desire is manifest eternally. And it can become covered. Then it's awakened by a practice. Prabhupada says over and over and over again that love for Krishna is dormant in the heart of all living entities. Well, that's not a general love for Krishna. It's a specific love for Krishna. If it was a general love for Krishna, how would we be individual persons? We wouldn't. It's very much like the people who think that all women are just sort of the same and they become whoever they marry. It's a very similar kind of philosophy that you hear sometimes from devotees, that women don't have any varna, they don't have any nature. There's no different natures between one woman and the other, that every single woman in the whole world simply has exactly the same propensities as every single other woman. And that when the Vedas talk about marrying men and women of the same varna, it doesn't really mean anything, because as soon as the woman marries her husband, she becomes his varna. But that's not true. It's not true in our practical experience. We see that women have different natures. And we don't see that just because a woman gets married that her nature becomes just like that of her husband, which is why they wanted the same varnas to marry. Why would you want the same varnas to marry if the woman became what her husband was? Then it wouldn't matter. You could marry anybody to anybody. So in a similar way, the soul has an inherent nature. And by bhakti, it comes out. Or you can think of it like you have a whole bunch of different seeds, and when you pour water on them, the different colors and shapes come out. You know, it looks like a pile of seeds. They all look pretty much the same. But they're all individual. And, of course, even on one plant that has 10 roses, no two roses are even exactly alike, even on the same plant. So when Prabhupada is talking about here, and it's talked about other places, that one will achieve whatever one has been meditating on, that... This is text 11. This is text 11. And it was in text 7 and 8 that we talked about the awakening of one's particular taste. the awakening of one particular rasa. So this is your rasa has awakened, and now you're meditating on serving Krishna, you're meditating on serving Radha in your rasa, and therefore you develop that, whatever you meditate on this life, you develop that in the spiritual world. But not like materially what you meditate on this life, which is all temporary. If I meditate on my dog in this life, I become a dog. But I very temporarily become a dog. I'm not eternally a dog. And if I meditate on, you know, a tree, I become a tree. But, it's not like that. It's not, the spiritual process is not like that material process where you meditate on cowherd boys and you become a cowherd boy if you're not a cowherd boy. In fact, if you're not a cowherd boy and you try to meditate on the cowherd boys, you're not going to feel relish in it. It won't really work. Because it's not who you are. Does that make sense to everybody? You know, it's you could talk about like people who are men and they dress up like women but they're not women. It doesn't matter how much they dress up like women and how much they try to act like women, but that's not what they are. No matter how much they meditate on women and how much they dress up like women, and even if they do surgery and stuff, they don't really become women. So if we try to meditate on, I'm sure there'll be women in the next life, but that's another thing. But if you just try to meditate on something because, and usually when people do this, of course, they choose the gopis because they figure the gopis are the highest and they figure that I'm the greatest person in the universe and therefore I should meditate on whatever's the highest. That's Hare Krishna. Yes. Well, if you're actually a gopi, then that's fine. Then once you meditate on being a gopi. So the same ways he contemplated during his life. The other thing is Prabhupada says to bathe in Radhakund, and people often ask, should we bathe in Radhakund or not? And for that I would say, please ask your spiritual master or your spiritual authority, because sometimes Prabhupada said, yes, bathe in Radhakund. Other times he said, no, just sprinkle the water on your head. Depends on who he was talking to, what are the circumstances. There's one place where he said Raghunath Das Goswami did Dandavat Parikrama of Radhakund and Shyamakund. And if you want to bathe in Radhakund, you can do that first. But this is something that is a question for your individual authorities, because there is not one right answer. Here we have Srila Prabhupada's books, which are his most authoritative in the sense that they apply to the most people. They're not such individualized instructions, where he's saying bathe in Radhakund as far as possible. But then there were individual instructions where he told people, no, you don't bathe in Radhakund, just put some drops on your head. All right, so we'll just summarize here, and then we can have a few questions, and then we need to end. So again, we start off with ourselves, control the senses, mind, anger, speech, food, and control not by becoming empty, but by using it for Krishna. Not by stopping, but by engaging. And then give up the six unfavorable things, and then favorable was mostly the too much. Too much food, too much money, too many things, too much knowledge, too many rules, or wrong kind of rules, wrong kind of friends, wrong kind of food. So too much, wrong kind. Or with rules, also wrong motive. And then take up the things you're going to need. You know, what are you going to need? You're going to need enthusiasm, patience, and confidence. And you need to follow the bona fide process. You can't make up your own process. And you get the bona fide process from the scriptures and from the examples of the acharyas. Okay, then you've done that. Now you can start having loving relationships, which are give and take with food, prasadam, and gifts. So giving people what they really want, what they really need, what they really enjoy, dealing with them as persons and as individuals, not giving people gifts and prasadam and confidences for your benefit, but for their benefit. Revealing your mind for the benefit of the person to whom you're revealing your mind, which is a very outrageous, amazing concept. And giving gifts and food for people because what they like, which sometimes is also a pretty amazing and controversial concept. And then receiving with gratitude and with love, and being willing to receive also. That receiving is part of loving exchanges, and have these loving exchanges equally, in a friendly, equal way with those who are your equals, in a reverential, serving way with those who are your superiors, and in a helping, compassionate way with those who are your inferiors. And remembering that this very same person might be inferior to you in one way, equal to you in another way, and superior to you in another way. So it's not just with people, but it's with areas of life. So you can learn something even from the animals on the street, right? You can learn loyalty from the dog, right? So the dog may be lower than you in so many ways, but the dog might be, maybe the dog has some quality that you lack. and not judging who's higher, lower, or the same based on the body. If the body's beautiful, that doesn't mean the person's higher than you. If the body's ugly, doesn't mean they're lower than you. If the body's sick or deformed, doesn't mean they're lower than you. You know, and dare we say, if it's a man or woman, doesn't mean they're lower than you, although that's another really controversial point. And you can just forget that I said that. But anyway, it has nothing to do with the body. Nothing to do with the body. What color skin you have, what color hair you have, where you're born, whether you're short, whether you're tall, whether you're fat, whether you're skinny. That's not how you tell. It's not that you look at people and say, oh, that person's a very elevated soul. There was a documentary made of this one Indian man who'd grown up in America who decided to prove that people didn't need gurus. And the way he did this, he did something which I would say is quite demoniac. So he went to India and he studied the behavior of saintly persons or those who pretended to be saintly persons. He studied them for about a year, grew out his hair, and copied his grandmother's accent, came to a place in America where nobody knew him, got two young, attractive women to be his PR people, and built himself as a guru, and advertised himself as a guru. He made up his own system of yoga, his own yoga asanas, he made up his own system of meditation, he made up his own parampara, he just made everything up. And he ended up getting about 11 or 12 disciples. Now, he later revealed to them who he was. He couldn't do it face to face. Yet he was too, because people had come to trust him. So he had done it first as a way to show that people were foolish, and then he got to know people as individuals and got to like them and got to care about them. And then it was very hard for him to reveal what he had done. It's actually quite a painful movie to watch. So then he goes back to his home and he shaves off his hair and his beard and he makes this video and then he just shows the video. And anyways, it was pretty intense. But one of the things that struck me is that people accepted him as a guru only on externals. On externals. Why did they choose him as a guru? Well, he had brown skin, he had an Indian accent, he had long hair, he had a beard. You know, he wore saffron clothes and he carried a funny trident thingy. You know, and also because he got booked in at yoga studios, so he would get introduced by someone at the yoga studio. That was also why he got accepted. But don't go by things like that. Don't go by, does the person have a beard, or did not have a beard, or, you know, what color is their clothing, or what, you know, oh, they're from India, they must be more spiritual, or they're older than, whatever. Oh, here's an old Indian man, he must be more advanced. Than a young British girl. You don't know. I mean, as I travel the world, I see that the most advanced devotees come in all ages and all sizes and all colors and all shapes and both genders and anything you can imagine. And people who are neophyte come in all of them too. There can be people with big titles who are neophyte, and there can be people washing the pots who are advanced. And there are people with big titles who are advanced and people washing the pots who are neophyte. And it doesn't work the other way either. It's not that all the leaders are in nonsense and all the pot washers are great devotees either. You know, and you really want to look for the symptoms and not for the externals. Okay, then we get to the process of bhakti, which was described, Prabhupada in his purport to text 7, described Shraddha Prema, which we went through in depth yesterday, and then in text 8, the stages of meditation, the 5 main stages with the 5 subcategories of the third stage, the depth of meditation, primarily depth and concentration, of mental meditation and then revelation meditation. We talked about getting that relish and then being absorbed 24 hours a day, and then today the best place, and the better and better and better and better and better and best person, and then specific glorification of Radhakund. So here we've gone from controlling the tongue to Radhakund in 11 verses. A whole progress of bhakti in 11 verses, really from the very bottom to the very top. All right. Thank you all very much. Those of you who were here for all 4 days, and those of you who are just here for today, and those of you who are just here for part of today, or whatever you were here for, I hope that I've done some service for you and that you're happy. I have quite a few things to get ready before I leave early tomorrow morning, but we could take maybe 5 minutes if anybody has questions. Yes.
I was thinking, because Nectar's instruction is both like a general instruction for everyone to advance, and then here is Rupa Goswami coming out of his own ecstasy and giving this gradation of best, obviously, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. it's not that Nanda Maharaj thinks that I should reside in Radhakund. Yeah, but simultaneously, Rupa Goswami is giving this book, which is general instruction for the general public, I mean, for everyone, at least I understand that.
And yeah, you're right. We have it as one of the Bhakti Shastri books, yeah. which is the lowest level, our lowest level Shastri degree.
Yeah, and then we end up with this instruction that that's the best place, and that's the best person, and that's the gradation. And then how you make sense of it?
Oh my, what a question. Well, I do see, as sometimes people come to me in different parts of the world and tell me, you know, wow, I've just understood that I'm in Vatsalya Rasa or I'm in Sakya Rasa. It does happen. I mean, it doesn't happen every day or every week or every month. But and if people do find that they're not gopis, they're sometimes quite difficult because we have this mood that everybody's supposed to be a gopi. But we don't find Srila Prabhupada preaching that everybody's supposed to be a gopi. And we don't find Rupa Goswami in, say, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, where he gives details about all the rasas saying that everybody should be a gopi. So I see that this book has to be understood within the whole context. That's true in general, that you don't take a particular sloka or a particular text out of context. So the general instruction is that everybody has their own particular relationship. So that's as far as... But it is a problem. I do see it as a practical problem because we do have devotees who, with all good intentions and well-meaning and, you know, just immature... Who think that everybody should try to be gopis, which you can't try to be something that you're not. You have to try to be who you are rather than... This is even true materially. It's even true materially. Krishna says, don't try to do someone else's job even if you think you can do it perfectly, because better to follow your own nature. So if that's even true for our very, very temporary, fleeting, little life nature, what to speak of for our eternal nature, the same principle is there. And... You know, from the beginning of time, neophyte spiritual practitioners cause some problems. It's just the way it is. What can be done? But I see here that what's wonderful about Mahaprabhu's teaching and the teachings of the Goswamis is that their encouragement to those who are in those rasas to develop them in this movement. You know, if you have those rasas and you're in other sampradayas or other traditions, it's going to be much more difficult. I mean, we have examples of Christian saints who developed in Madhurya Rasa. St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, for example, who are definitely in Madhurya Rasa. There's no, oh, yeah. There's no question about it at all. Have you ever read St. Teresa of Avila's Interior Mansions? It was Janavi who told me to read that book. And I read that and went, wow. She starts with Vikarma. She talks about the interior mansions of the soul. She starts with Vikarma and she ends with Madhurya Rasa. It sounds like Swakya rather than Parkya. But she ends with Madhurya Rasa. She has a very long description of the sixth mansion, which appears to be Bhava. She appears to be describing basically Shraddha to Prema. But she starts even below Shraddha with Karma and Vikarma. I mean, what's fascinating to me about Teresa of Avila's book. And she and St. John of the Cross, of course, were on the planet at the same time as Mahaprabhu. But what really is fascinating about it is that she's using some Christian dogma. You follow? She's putting things in Christian terminology, referring to Christian dogma, but doesn't seem to be a hindrance for her. She did have a problem that when she started, sometimes exhibiting ecstasies, that the church tried to stop her. And because she had taken vows of obedience, chastity, and poverty, particularly obedience, so if her church superior said, you know, you can't do this, you can't do this kind of prayer, you can't do this kind of meditation, she would try to stop out of obedience. And she writes in one of her other books, it's The Way of Perfection, which is instruction to the nun, she writes, please make sure you get a proper confessor to guide you, because if somebody isn't aware of what your mood is, they can do you a lot of harm. And she had that personal experience, because the people who were her guides and mentors couldn't relate at all to what was going on with her, and they would often say, these things are of the devil. Mm-hmm. It was fascinating when she describes Bhava She says, I concluded this didn't come from the devil because the devil cannot cause such exquisite pain. She describes Baba very much as a pain of separation. So, is it possible to realize, as St. John of the Cross was also heavily persecuted for his teaching that God has a romantic life. So he wasn't exactly treated very kindly by the church, let's put it that way, if you want to look at the history. So is it possible to attain to these states outside, you know, of the... Of course. It's not that you can't. Although it's interesting, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has this book about where all the great acharyas meet Lord Chaitanya. Because we say without a touch with Lord Chaitanya, it's not possible. But it's so much more difficult. I mean, so much more difficult to do it in that life, you follow? If you really are in one of the higher rasas, but you're in a system that's not teaching it and not facilitating it, it's going to be very difficult to attain to that state in that lifetime. It's possible. There's Krishna's kripa, and anything is possible with Krishna's kripa. But it's difficult. It's very difficult. You know, how are you going to do PhD mathematics in a primary school? Some people do. But, you know, it's hard to get the support and the help you need, and people are going to think that you're very odd. And you may even be discriminated against, as St. John of the Cross was, very severely so. So I see that they're making this available. They're making it available, they're making it open. And that way, anybody in any of the rasas following Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu can very easily achieve who they are. That it's very open and it's very easily achievable. Whereas without that, it's not so easily achievable. And if you think about it also for a minute, although we have very much a culture in ISKCON of the gopis are the best and the gopis are the best, think about how awkward it is for somebody to awaken to the fact that they have a conjugal relationship with God. That's a little awkward, isn't it? I mean, it's a lot less awkward to awaken to the fact that God is your child, or God is your friend, or God is your master. It's a lot easier for a living entity who's in conditioned life. Even those entities who become gopis from sadhana bhakti, like the sages from the Dandakaranya forest and the personified Vedas, it was a little hard for them to deal with the idea that as gopis in Parakiya Rasa, they were not following the dharma of the Vedas. It was not easy for them at all. You know, when Krishna took their clothes, they were like, we can't come out of the water. You know, it was not easy at all. It's interesting, though, in Gopal Champu, Jiva Goswami writes that even Krishna was thinking, oh, wow, I'm in love with all these married women. What am I going to do? I have to follow dharma. But I have so much prema, I don't know what I'm going to do about it. So that's kind of interesting. So you can see that it would be difficult. And therefore I see that there's a lot of openness in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. So the door is opened for those who are in Madhurya Ras to find that comfort and that safety and that they can develop like that. Whereas without that, it would be extremely difficult. Yes, I hope that answers your question.
Trying to explain my questions.
Okay.
Like we're talking about in Mahaprabhu's mission, that he's come to give premium for primary rasas.
Yes.
And we hear in CC that he's going to give Krishna Prem, make the whole world dance with Krishna Prem.
Yes.
And then, it's just something that's on my mind anyway, so somehow Krishna Major in the class. And then, you're talking about that the devotees there, some are going to Vaikuntha, some are going to the Ram's Leela, to Mishrindev's Leela, and so on. How they will all get danced with Krishna Prem in those four rasas, something I'm just... How that's happening in this Kali Yuga.
Well, even if they're going to Ayodhya, those rasas are there in Ayodhya, and the rasas are there also in Vaikuntha. It's not that the people in Ayodhya don't have prema, or the people in Vaikuntha don't have prema. It's a little different kind of prema.
That's what I'm trying to understand.
It's a different flavor of prema. Yeah.
That's,
you know, but they can still all dance with prema.
Like Prahlad Maharaj's Rasadev Dutt. which type of pranayama
yes.
dancing.
Or, you know, of course, I don't know if Bhishma is in Mahaprabhu's Lila, but, you know, Bhishma was attracted to the Lord in Vaikuntha. Mm. He glorified the gopis, he wanted the blessings of the gopis, but that wasn't his attraction. And of course, we have people in Mahaprabhu's Lila who were attracted to Ram. We have some people in Mahaprabhu's Lila who were attracted to Ram, and after meeting Mahaprabhu, they became attracted to Krishna. See, that's what I mean. It's available. It's available. All these rasas and all the dealings with Krishna are available through Mahaprabhu and through the Goswamis. So if that is one's inherent nature, one can awaken that easily in this life, in this sampradaya, which cannot be done so much in other sampradayas. It's more difficult. But it's not that, you know, with Murari Gupta, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu glorified him. How wonderful is the servant who cannot give up his master and the master who cannot give up his servant. And that other, I love the story with the Ram Bhakta in South India, where Mahaprabhu, you know, finds the Kurma Purana and takes out the original page and has the page copied, inserts a copied page within the original manuscript to take the original page to this Brahmana to reassure him that Ravana only kidnapped a false Sita. So he was, and Lord Chaitanya was very pleased with this Ram Bhakta's worship. And this Ram Bhakta did not become a Krishna Bhakta. So, you know, it's everybody can dance in prema in their own way. Unity and diversity. So the whole world can, it's not that the people in Vaikuntha never dance. Every day is a festival, I'm sure they're dancing. And we have, you know, I was just reading in Chaitanya Charitamrita how on Janmashtami, you know, Lord Chaitanya and his associates all dressed up like cowherd boys. And Dvaitacharya is saying, I'm going to know you're a coward boy if you can wheel this rod around, you know. But then on Ram Vijaya or Ram Navami, I forget which, they were all dressed up like monkeys. And Lord Chaitanya was in Hanuman's ecstasy and they were all playing that they were building a bridge. So it's. And then, of course, you know that there are some devotees who are in more than one lila.
Yeah.
Some devotees are in Chaitanya Lila and Krishna Lila. Some devotees are in Ram Lila and Chaitanya Lila, like Murari Gupta. Some devotees are in Ram Lila, Chaitanya Lila, and Krishna Lila. Some are in Ram Lila and Krishna Lila. So there's. Would that be fun to be able to be in more than one place at one time with more than one nature and service at one time? So there are also people like that.
Mahaprabhu, because he's avatari, he's
represent. He's also Akhila Rasa Mitamurti, so everything is there, yes.
So he's the yesterday of Kali, this Kali Yuga, really.
Yes. But why can't everybody dance in prema in the whole world? Some people are going to be dancing in prema as in Vatsalya Ras, and some are going to be dancing as Ram Bhaktas, as Ram's monkeys, and you know, I mean, that's why not? Is that okay?
Yes, I'm
we don't all have to be gopis to all dance in prema, or all cowherd boys, or something, just to all dance. Anybody else? Yes.
I wanted to ask a question, but I feel like I've just dived into something, so I don't know if I can even get the question to make sense.
If it doesn't make sense, I'll just tell you, that doesn't make any sense, and then that will be over.
so you just said that so somebody can kind of uncover their inherent nature within, as in this movement, there's a space to become...
To uncover all the natures, whatever it is, whereas in other movements, that space isn't so much there. It's not so easy.
So that means potentially you could find those rasas within you. Is that what you're saying? As a jiva, I'm trying to understand.
Not those who you are. You are somebody. You already are somebody. You are eternally somebody, or maybe even more than one somebody's. Maybe you have more than one role, but you are eternally somebody. It's who you are. And the whole process is revive your Krishna consciousness. Uncover. Go back to Godhead. The language is all like that. So Mahaprabhu's movement gives facility for all jivas in all rasas with all incarnations. Whatever your rasa is, it becomes very easy. Can you do that in another sampradaya or even in another religion. But yeah, but you're not going to get any support. You're going to be very much alone. You won't have any guidance. You'd be heavily dependent on Kripa, because you won't be given any kind of a sadhana. Do you understand? You know, Saint Teresa had to explain her own sadhana process because it wasn't given to her by her church. It was manifest in the heart, and she taught others. But, and you can, if you read what she's doing, you can see there's a lot of jnana yoga in her process.
Is it autobiography?
I wouldn't exactly call it that. It's got a lot of autobiographical elements in it. So she's definitely, to some extent, describing her own inner journey. But it is as much a description of the journey as it is a description of her journey. It's both. It's very much both. But, you know, how would you do that? It's so much more difficult. And you can see that it's going to be a very, very rare person. Extremely, extremely rare person who's going to, in that lifetime, in that system, be able to fully realize who they are. That will be extremely unusual. Whereas in Mahaprabhu's movement, it's going to be extremely common. Now, is that going to happen to every single person in Mahaprabhu's movement in this life? No way. Definitely not. But anybody who takes up the process, well, then yes, why not? That's Prabhupada's assurance to us. Is everybody in the Hare Krishna movement taking up the process seriously? No. I don't know I have no idea what the percentages are. For those who take it seriously, that's what should happen. And it's easy for it to happen in one life, and one has the guidance for it to happen in one life. Whereas in other systems, it will be very difficult. And it would seem that most of them will have to take it more than one life.
Association is that?
Yeah, we have the books, we have the guidance, we have the association. We have the just even the concept. So if you go to most religions and you say, what's your concept of perfection? What is their concept of perfection? It's very unclear. Many of them don't even have a concept of prema and bhakti at all. Their concept is just of swarga or brahman maybe. So if you're in a religious system where the highest concept is just material heaven, I mean, again, it's possible. It's not that it's impossible. If you're worshiping Jesus or Muhammad, and they can also help you. You know, it's not that they can't help you. But it will be so much more difficult, and you'll feel so weird. I mean, just imagine these people. I mean, another thing Teresa was writing, she said, you know, God is so far beyond and so radically different than what we understand him as. But I don't think she wasn't in an environment to speak. Even as much as she spoke, she ended up getting restricted many times. Is that clear?
Yeah.
No, you are who you are, who you are, who you are, who you are. It's just a question of uncovering. It's not a question of anything else other than a discovery and an uncovering. Yes?
I've been hearing recently some people saying it's by the association. Not like that. What's clear in Prabhupada, it's always like that.
Always.
Shame
always.
Shame you didn't bring those quotes in there.
Well, but exactly what I'm saying here. The association has something to do with it, because if you don't have the proper association, it may be difficult to realize your actual nature. You're then dependent very, very strongly on direct mercy from God. You're dependent on Krishna saying, wow, this person doesn't have this facility, so I'm going to give them some direct revelation that's beyond what they have in their association. And of course, he can do that, but we see he generally doesn't. He's generally going through the devotees. So, yeah, if you don't have that association, it may take you more than one life, basically, is what I see. Or it may take you until, you know, until Krishna decides to give you that association so that you can help. But if people say that our rasa develops only by association, then how are they defining our eternal personality? That is my question. And that is the question to ask. First of all, if you're going to look at Sadhu Shastra Guru, it's all about awakening and it's all about inherent. Always. Then, okay, so that's Shabda. Then if you want to look at Anuman, if you want to look at logic, if you say that our eternal personality is simply the result of who we associate with, to me that's very much like saying the woman just becomes whatever her husband is. Mm-hmm. And that's, it's just not true. If that were true, then when Ajamil married the Sudrani, she would have become a Brahmana. It just isn't, it isn't reality. We don't see that. We see that we can be in the different modes according to our, so you know, there's certain things that happen because of our association, but it doesn't change our inherent nature. Krishna never says to Arjuna, you know, well, yeah, your nature is totally changeable, it just depends on who you hang out with. That's not what he says. He said you have a nature and it's not going to change. It's just a question of what you use it for. And he was talking about something material. I mean, Arjuna, but he was, you know, as far as instruction to us, he was talking about like being a kshatriya. He wasn't talking about rasa. Does that make sense to you? And I would, you know, you don't have to ask these people. You can let people think whatever they want to think. You know, it's not our business to convince anybody, really. But that's the question is, well, what am I before that then?
And what's going to make you choose who you're going to associate with?
Well, that's another good question. Is that just some random thing? Is it just some random thing that you just happen to be associating with people who have a cowherd boy mentality, so you develop as a cowherd boy? But then to me the big question is, well, what were you before? Were you just nothing? You were just some sort of blob?
Yes.
You know, and just since the beginning, beginningless time, you were just a blob? By the way, whoever says this, they also say that we didn't fall from the spiritual world. They must. If you fell from the spiritual world, then you already had a rasa, and then there's no question of developing a completely different rasa in terms of association. That would make no sense. But even if someone says we didn't fall from the spiritual world, then they're saying that we exist in some sort of a not... How are you a person? I don't really get how you're a person. I mean, I've asked people who have this philosophy, how are we people then? What does it mean that I'm an individual person? Eternally. What? How do you define personality? What do we mean when we say somebody has a personality? What do I mean? You have certain traits and you don't have other traits. You're very cautious or you're very risk-taking. You know. What do you like? What do you not like? But again, if you say, well, we have a personality, okay. So eternally, I like yellow better than green. And that's my eternal personality. But I don't have an eternal relationship with Krishna. So you're saying you have an eternal personality that's not in relationship with Krishna? Then how is it real? That's the definition of illusion, something that's not in relationship with Krishna. So you're saying your eternal personality is an illusion? No, it's who I really am. Okay, but who you really are has to be in relationship with Krishna, otherwise it's not real. And if it's in relationship with Krishna, then it has a relationship with Krishna. And if it has a relationship with Krishna, then it has a specific relationship with Krishna. So that's Anuman. That's logic. I haven't heard anyone who says that, if I ask them, how do you define personality? First of all, they don't like to answer the question. And if they answer it, they'll just say, well, we're separate from one another. And again, that implies to me a geographical kind of separateness, which is, again, not consistent with our shastra in terms of understanding of space. You get this mental picture of just these identical little white lights all floating in space and not touching each other. So where does that come from? What sadhu shastra guru is telling us, and how is that... you know, I'm very sorry to say this, I really am, but doesn't that sound just a little bit maybe impersonal? Just maybe, just as maybe, possibly, could it be that it seems to be to me that it just might be a little bit impersonal, that it sounds to me like this sort of idea is that our original position is just merged in the Brahman and that we're all just sort of one in the Brahman. And then somehow in the material world, we develop a spiritual personality. And again, I don't know what individuality means in that context. What does it mean? I'm not only an individual because my body is in a different location from your body. That's not the only thing that makes me an individual. If I'm sitting on your lap, I'm still an individual. I mean, it just, my individuality is quite different from that. Of a different nature. Is that okay?
Yeah.
I've been really endeavoring not to waste my time arguing such things with people.
So it came to me, I wasn't.
Yeah, no, it comes to me too. Yeah. It comes to me too. But I've also found that if people are making arguments that don't have firm backing from Sadhu Shastra Guru and are not very logical, that if you press them on it, they just become angry and defensive. That's my experience, which is not very good for them, so it's not a very beneficial discussion.
Thank you.
If we never get really good at Vaidisandra Bhakti,
can you ever go to Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti?
Just, can you have a really uncomfortable relationship?
Well, that was kind of what Jayanti asked yesterday. Is it possible for somebody who's not perfect in Vaidisandra Bhakti? The answer, of course, is yes, of course it's possible, but don't plan on it. And don't structure your life that way. It's entirely possible for someone to take one drop of Charanamrita water and fully awaken to the love of God. That's entirely possible. It's impossible to follow a Rathyatra cart one time. Rupa Goswami says so. Urmila's not saying so. Rupa Goswami says so. Hey, right here it says that you can bathe in Radhakund one time. You could be not following Vaidisadhana Bhakti at all, and you could bathe in Radhakund one time because you're some tourist from Germany who happened to go to Vrindavan with a tour group, a yoga group, and you bathe in Radhakund one time, and you could awaken your eternal swarup. Rupa Goswami says so. Prabhupada says so. So I'll just believe them. But convenient, right? I'll just believe them, that's possible. Does it happen to some people? Yes. That's very unusual. You don't plan for that. You don't say, well, I'm not going to follow Vaidisadhana Bhakti very strictly. I'll just go bathe in Radhakund one time. That mentality is offensive. If it just so happens that you're a German tourist in Radhakund, and it just so happens that you bathe in Radhakund and Krishna gives you some kripa, you know, well, jai. But that's not the way you go about it. So, is it possible? Yes. Does it happen sometimes? I'm sure it happens sometimes. Undoubtedly it happens sometimes. You know, I certainly don't expect it to happen to me. I'm not like, okay, Krishna, you know, let's just skip this Gayatri and let's just, you know, not bother offering this food and, you know, let's cut this corner and cut that corner and cut that corner. But nor should we think that it's a mechanical process, that if I just tick all the right boxes and punch all the right buttons in the right order, that it's like a vending machine. Krishna doesn't like being treated that. That's just the Niyamagraha and Niyamagraha, way back in text 2. So this is the Niyamagraha and Niyamagraha. There's one where you say, all I have to do is follow the rules. If I follow the rules, I'll become perfect because Krishna is a machine. That would be just like if some guy says, okay, here's your dozen roses, now love me. You'd say, excuse me. I'm sorry. I'm not for sale. Right? So, you know, Krishna will say the same thing. He says, I'm sorry, I'm not for sale. You can't purchase me with your number of mantras and your numbers of waving incense and all your vows and your... 11th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, it's not by austerity, it's not by vows, it's not by this, it's not by that. And then, in the next verse purport, Prabhupada says, all those things done in bhakti will show Krishna, and those things done without bhakti will not. So nor should you have the mentality that, well, okay, it's not a mechanical process, and it's not that I punch a bunch of buttons and Krishna jumps out like a jack-in-the-box, and, you know, he's a person. So I'm just going to deal with him emotionally. I'm just going, oh, Krishna, I love you. And, okay, did you follow your vows? No, but I love you. Did you give me something to eat? No, but I love you. That's not going to cut it either. Right? So if some guy claims he loves you and he never gives you flowers and he never gets out of bed and he never talks to you, you know, that's not going to work either. Do you follow what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So it's not mechanical. It's not mechanical. Krishna can do what he wants. Krishna can award prema bhakti to whoever he wants, and he can awaken that. Of course, it's the person's choice to have to embrace it. But Krishna can awaken that in whoever he wants. He's independent. And why he might choose to do that to somebody, who knows? I mean, that's his business. I suppose you can talk about it with him at some point. And at the same time, we should think that if I want to attain love of God, I should do what God tells me to do. If I say, you know, if you want to be my friend, please do this, then do that. Pretty simple. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Guru Goswami Ki Jai.